This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 4 months ago, horrific pictures of American military personnel abusing inmates at Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison shocked the world. The U.S. government launched several inquiries to examine the treatment of prisoners in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The commission with the authority to go highest up the chain of command was an independent panel appointed by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, headed by former Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger. Its report, released yesterday, said that the worst abuses, purposeless sadism, it called it, were carried out by soldiers and military intelligence personnel on the night shift at Abu Ghraib, not to extract information, but, in the words of one participant, just for the fun of it. Commanders at Abu Ghraib were cited for poor leadership, their commanders in Baghdad were blamed for ignoring obvious warning signs, and their commanders, top civilian and military brass at the Pentagon, were blamed for bad planning, for sending confusing signals about what was allowed and what wasn't, and for failing to provide enough military police, interpreters, and interrogators. The conclusions of another report on Abu Ghraib are being issued today. More on that later. But first, we want to focus on the report of the Schlesinger Commission. If you have questions about what happened at Abu Ghraib and why, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his home in San Diego, California, is Harold Brown, Secretary of Defense under President Jimmy Carter, and a member of the independent panel picked by Donald Rumsfeld. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Glad to be with you.
Let's begin the beginning and begin at the top. To what degree do these abuses stem from plans made before the invasion of Iraq?
One of the important elements of the context in which all this happened was the belief by senior Defense Department people and the rest of the administration as well, most of the people in the administration, that after the successful overthrow of Saddam Hussein and a very efficient and well-run military campaign, that there would be a period during which Iraq could become stabilized, that there would be reconstruction, and that things would be pretty well stabilized. Now, they did make some contingency plans. They planned for attacks on the oil-producing facilities. There were contingency plans for a large number of refugees who might be displaced as a result of communal strife, for example. So there were plans for contingencies, but not for the contingency that happened. That is, massive looting, destruction of infrastructure, and after a period during which Iraqis were grateful that Saddam Hussein had been overthrown, a resentment of what was seen as an occupation and an increasing insurgency situation. So you had a continuing combat situation in Iraq that had not been prepared for, and that influenced the situation as regards prisoners, because many detainees were picked up of various kinds, a mixture of detainees, individuals who were really prisoners of war, some unreconstructed Ba'athists, foreign fighters and domestic fighters who were Islamic extremists, ordinary criminals, and undoubtedly some innocent people who were just picked up because somebody had a grudge against them and wanted to see them in jail. So that was a very important contributing factor. Another one was that the policy that was set up for interrogation shifted back and forth. There is an Army Field Manual, 34-52, which has for many, many years been the directive that determines what methods of interrogation are used. Following 9/11, the president made a determination that terrorists of that sort were not covered by the Geneva Convention, and that in the case of Afghanistan, the Taliban was not really a government, and that those people were not covered by the Geneva Conventions. So something had to be done about establishing a set of directions for interrogation. And I would say that Secretary Rumsfeld behaved very carefully and very effectively in that regard. He set up some additional methods, which, however, could be used only with his specific permission.
And which the report says were used just twice in Guantanamo Bay with good results.
That's correct, and only on two people. But what then happened was that those lists, which contained many things that the Secretary of Defense never approved to have used even in Guantanamo, and a list which he did not approve for use anywhere else, migrated to Afghanistan and migrated along with some of the interrogators and military police from Afghanistan to Iraq.
And effectively, this confusion, the report says, gave people the impression that there was a green light.
It gave them much more leeway than, in fact, they thought they had more leeway than had, in fact, been granted. So those were the underlying problems. They were compounded by the fact that there weren't nearly enough military police or military interrogators in Iraq.
The report says 1-to-1 was the relationship of guards to prisoners in Guantanamo Bay. It all worked well there. When it was 1-to-75 at Abu Ghraib, it didn't work very well at all.
That's correct. And there was also not a clear-cut set of directions as to what the military intelligence people were supposed to do and what the military police were supposed to do. In addition, you had a poor set of command arrangements at Abu Ghraib, and I would say that that there were personnel difficulties. That is to say, the MP and MI commanders didn't get along with each other, and in fact, right up to the brigade level, there was inadequate supervision and inadequate command. I should correct one thing you said. I think you said that the pictures that were shown of Block 1A, mm-hmm. the so-called animal house on the night shift, included military police and intelligence people. There were no interrogators involved in that particular case, but there were interrogators and intelligence people involved in about a third of the abuses elsewhere at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And in those circumstances, not the incidents at Tier 1, those were, the report says, purposeless sadism, and they account for two-thirds of the incidents at Abu Ghraib. But in the other third, those did occur in an effort to extract information from detainees?
That's correct.
And you use the word, the report uses the word, throughout brutality, it uses abuses. Isn't that torture?
People can define torture the way they want. In the extreme case, the International Committee of the Red Cross defines interrogation of prisoners of war as torture. In other words, asking them questions. And I think that's rather excessive. Clearly, there was brutality here. I am not aware, and I don't. We looked, and investigations are continuing. We did not see examples of torture in an attempt to extract information. I suspect people did get pushed around. There were cases. There's a well-known case which took place on the battlefield, where, of course, the situation is perhaps most fraught. People have been shooting at you. You capture some of them. And in this particular case, a captured attacker was interrogated, and a lieutenant colonel in charge of the battalion allowed his troops to beat the person, and then in an attempt to find out where the other people were who were shooting at them. Then he himself shot off a gun right next to, but not at, the prisoner, got the information, saved his troops. He realized that he had violated the rules. He turned himself in, and he was fined and discharged. Now, I suppose you could call that torture, and in any event, it was contrary to regulations.
Let me. We asked you to take it from the beginning and the top down, and you did a fine job with that. Let me turn it around and look from the bottom up. Some of the soldiers, the privates and non-coms who've been charged in this regard said, we were just following orders. On the basis of your investigation, do they have a claim to say that?
I think not. I mean, I think certainly the individuals who have been charged so far, who are the ones on from Tier 1A, were not following anyone's orders. That was self-generated. They even said some of them said they did it for fun. And so far as I know, they haven't identified anyone who gave them such orders.
A couple of other questions. Last week, a British medical journal, The Lancet, reported that American military medics were complicit in the abuse at Abu Ghraib. Did your report look into that?
We refer to that in the report and say that you need to define those rules more clearly. Certainly, if a detainee had a medical problem and then was treated by a physician or by a medic, and of course, a medic does not subscribe to the Hippocratic Oath. There's a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And then afterwards is interrogated, I suppose that you could get the kind of charge that appears in the Lancet, that they were helping in the interrogation. Certainly that is, you know, that again is a matter of interpretation. The regulation is that physicians are not supposed to participate in interrogations. They're supposed to, according to all the rules, according to the Geneva Conventions, they're supposed to treat medical conditions. And perhaps those rules need to be defined more precisely. But we did not find examples of physicians participating in interrogations that went over the line.
Another thing, your commission looked into Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo Bay. As you know, there are an undefined number of people being detained at undisclosed locations by people we're not quite so sure of, but let's say the CIA, for lack of a better word. On the basis of what you found out in these other examples, should we be concerned about abuses in those places?
Well, we did not have full access to the CIA investigation, which, so far as I know, is still going on. We did talk with them and learn something about the fact that there is an investigation, but we were not privy to those details. Clearly, that does need to be investigated further, and we so indicate in our report.
Just 30 seconds left, Secretary Brown. People are being tried. Other people are being reprimanded. How high up should accountability go?
Well, responsibility, of course, goes all the way up to the top, but it's responsibility in varying degrees. I believe that there will be follow-up to these reports, and individuals will have their responsibility assessed. As I say, responsibility for errors of omission, failure to do some things, extends quite high up.
Secretary Brown, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Harold Brown, former Secretary of Defense under President Carter and a member of the independent panel appointed by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to investigate prisoner abuse. He joined us by phone from his home in San Diego, California. We're talking about the report on prisoner abuse, and we're taking your calls after the break, 800-989-8255, email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about reports on prisoner abuse in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And with us is Michael Hirsch, the senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He's been tracking these reports on prisoner abuse. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Happy to be here.
Let's switch momentarily. We were talking with Secretary Brown a moment ago about the Schlesinger Commission report. He was a member of that. The so-called Faye Jones report is being released as we speak. There's a news conference underway at the Pentagon. Briefly tell us, what's that about and what are we learning?
Well, this is one of, I think, five separate investigations that have been underway stemming from the Abu Ghraib abuses. This one conducted by the Army itself into its own operations. It has an interesting story because it began as a lower-level investigation by a two-star general, and then as evidence indicated that there might be higher-ups implicated, particularly General Sanchez himself, the head of Joint Task Force 7, the Army decided to appoint a higher-ranking general who would take it further up the chain, who was General Jones. So it became known as the Faye Jones Report. And what it's concluded basically is that this does go beyond the seven MPs who've been so far charged. The Bush administration has made a point of saying it's just these few. The Army itself is now concluding that responsibility, at least, for the abuses at Abu Ghraib goes beyond that.
General Paul Kern was the appointing authority for the investigation, and he had these remarks at the news conference at the Pentagon.
We conducted an investigation that focused on the 205th Military Intelligence Brigade and its chain of command. However, we went where the facts led us. Our final report is complete and has been turned in. In the course of this investigation, we discovered serious misconduct and a loss of moral values. We set out on our course to find the truth, not to whitewash, and also not to convict those people who were not incriminated.
And, Michael, let me ask you about that last statement in terms of not just this Faye Jones report, but the Schlesinger report as well. This is an independent commission? Are these credible inquiries?
Well, I think the Army inquiry is more by the book. There were two separate inquiries, mainly by the Army. One that looked into the original allegations conducted, abuses conducted by military police, those you saw in the photographs, the infamous photographs. Then there was this separate investigation as it became clear that military intelligence people were implicated, particularly the MPs themselves said, look, we were urged to do these kinds of things by military intelligence, which is a separate, you know, branch of the Army. And so that
they said that set the conditions for interrogation, yes.
Well, right. I mean, that was clearly something that was done. There were questions about whether an approach at Guantanamo Bay toward Taliban and al-Qaeda became effectively the approach against Iraqi detainees, and that's all what's being investigated here. I think that when it comes to the Schlesinger Commission report, there you can raise real questions about independence, because here the four members of that panel were also members of Donald Rumsfeld's own Defense Policy Board, his advisory panel, and indeed were asked by him only to give them quote-unquote professional advice. And so I think there are real questions about whether any panel so constituted could really be independent.
Here's an email question on that point from Alyssa in St. Louis. How can we refer to this commission as independent when, as I understand it, she writes, all of the members belong to a group think tank closely tied to Mr. Rumsfeld's Pentagon?
Right. Well, that's I assume that she's referring to the Defense Policy Board. Now, I don't want to impugn the integrity of people like James Schlesinger and Harold Brown. I think they made a real effort here. In fact, I think the conclusions of this, as we reported a couple weeks ago, went beyond what anyone expected in terms of laying blame at higher levels up to Rumsfeld's office itself. And yet, at the same time, there's a curious disconnect in this report where, again and again, section after section in the report, they say the problems were those of lack of planning, lack of personnel, lack of troops, lack of training, all problems that, frankly, have to go right up to the desk of the defense secretary himself. And yet, the criticism of Rumsfeld and senior civilian officials in the Pentagon is very muted, very indirect. And so I wouldn't call this a whitewash, but I do think that they bent over backwards to lay blame higher than the uniformed commanders in the field.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Joe. Joe's with us from Indianapolis.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
I wanted to ask about the people who died in our custody. I understand that a number of people died, and I think that suggests at least torture. I mean, should we be talking about murder here? And I want to say also that this is clear that the executive branch of the government was involved in this. We have the Justice Department memos and Henry Gonzalez, the White House lawyer, you know, looking for loopholes in the Geneva Convention to exploit, to allow what took place to take place.
Well, the Defense Department's also part of the executive branch, but go
right.
ahead.
Well, it's Alberto Gonzalez, by the way, the White House lawyer. There are, you know, look, there are serious problems, I was pointing out just before, with gaps in this report. I mean, for example, the only real documents the Schlesinger Report refers to are ones released by the White House itself, when my publication and others over the past couple of months have reported that there were several meetings of Albert Gonzalez, Bush's own lawyer, other senior officials, including Vice President Dick Cheney's lawyer, in which they discussed in very specific terms interrogation techniques at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. So, you know, there are vast areas that are left uncovered, really, by these reports, and perhaps will come out in some of the hearings in the fall. As far as the detainee deaths, I mean, that's one of the things that's come to light here, is that there were more abuse cases than the Army has previously let on. Although the number of cases of actual death by abuse so far are relatively few, and the ones that we know about, but they do raise questions about other agencies involved here, particularly the CIA and CIA contractors, because some of those cases that are under investigation did indeed occur under CIA auspices, and in fact the CIA Inspector General's office is looking into some of those cases right now, and we don't know whether that report will come to light.
Joe, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Mark. Mark's with us from Newport, North Carolina.
Thank you, Neil.
Hi.
Yes, my question was, which was, I think, answered just recently by Mr. Hirsch there, about how they were going to investigate the CIA's involvement in this. I understand the military intelligence and CIA are separate agencies, correct?
That is correct, yeah.
Okay. Now, I liked what the caller was bringing up before about the detainee deaths and things like this. The question for the main part about it is, of course, what all of this is about is whether this was policy or a few bad apples. We have the executive branch wanting, obviously, to show that it was a few bad apples and not a part of policy. But, I mean, if we think about the CIA's history since the end of World War II, in 97 you had the Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, which was using stressful positions and sleep deprivation and other forms of things that we're seeing right now in Iraq. Not to mention, you know, the CIA's training of the SAVAK under the 24-year dictatorship of the Shah. You have the Latin American Hondurans, the Nicaraguans. You have all of these instances. If we are not directly involved in the torture, we are also turning a blind eye when our allies did it. Just as Bush himself has said, Abu Ghraib was infamous as a torture chamber under the Butcher of Baghdad, which was true in the early 80s.
Mark,
our support,
Mark, could you,
we were helping and training.
Mark, excuse me. We want to get on to other calls. Is there a question there?
What was that?
The question then is the CIA's involvement. Secretary Brown said they were not able to look at even the CIA's investigation into its own conduct in these cases. Correct, Michael?
That's right, and I think that is going to be one of the biggest question marks going forward, CIA involvement. I don't want to get too conspiratorial about this. I mean, I think there's some of the things the caller was referring to, the training of the Iranian secret police and so forth. The bad old days of the CIA, I mean, there's a definite divide between what happened back then and today's CIA. There was a whole human rights backlash against some CIA practices, which changed the organization. But nonetheless, in the post-9/11 environment, the CIA was authorized to go and do rougher stuff. I should point out, though, that this could only happen with the authorization of the president himself and a series of directives that he signed, which gave the CIA leave to do some of these things. I don't know whether this is ever going to come out because it's all classified, and the CIA report may never be made public. We will have to see. But this is a this is a huge dimension of this story that has gone largely untold so far. I mean, one example for that hasn't really come out is that when Major General Jeffrey Miller went from Guantanamo Bay to Abu Ghraib to change the practices there, one of the issues that's being examined here, a senior member of the team that went with him was a CIA official. As I've seen in some of the documents that I've obtained. And so there are questions about how deeply involved CIA with their separate standards of interrogation were in the interrogation rooms of tier one, cell block tier 1A and in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Traditionally, the Army, military intelligence, and CIA have done things in separate rooms, separately. And I think for a long period of the war on terror, they did. But it's also clear, and the Schlesinger Commission report says this pretty flatly, that there was a leeching effect. There was migration of practices from one place to another and happening in an environment when there was no clear direction from the Pentagon, and that's really where the responsibility of senior Pentagon officials lies.
Mark, thank you.
I'm sorry, but the CIA of old, when did we know that this changed? Admitting, Mr. Man I'm talking to, that the secrecy behind the CIA and events that the CIA was involved in have still not been released to the public. And how would we be able to tell between the CIA of old, who supported torturers and these things, and the new post 9/11 CIA?
Maybe
how are they prepared to deal with the intelligence crisis, you know?
Yeah, it is a legitimate question. You are right. Much of what the CIA do, for obvious reasons, is not made public. There has not been a full reckoning of what the CIA did. But, you know, there is a historical record, and people who cover the intelligence community can say, I think with some confidence, that there was a change in practices, particularly after the Church Commission findings.
We want to bring in three opinions, perspectives, to help us get a view of these reports. And let's begin with Eugene Fidel. He's president of the National Institute of Military Justice, and he joins us by phone from his office here in Washington. Good to speak with you again.
Hi, Neil.
From a military justice perspective, do you think the Schlesinger report is tough enough on both military and civilian senior commanders?
Well, the fact is that these kinds of issues, when you're talking about senior commanders, tend not to play out as military justice issues. Let me expand on that a little bit. Where you're talking about people down where the rubber meets the road, people who were getting their hands dirty, people who are actually, you know, in the confinement facility, that's relatively easy to plug into the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or UCMJ.
Mm-hmm.
As you get further up the chain, you can still, the uniform chain, you can still, you know, as you get a little bit up the pyramid, you can still push things into various conceptual cubbyholes within the UCMJ. For example, the concept of dereliction of duty, which is employed for failures of supervision. That can be the basis for court-martial process or for non-judicial punishment, both of which take place under the UCMJ. But where you get the kinds of shortcomings, let's say, and I'm not making any judgment calls here, please. You understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
But where the concern is failures of judgment or preparation in the largest sense at the highest tiers of the uniformed services, accountability tends to be achieved outside the framework of the UCMJ. It tends to be achieved by firing people, by telling them it's time to retire, by transferring them to a different unit. That may be frustrating, particularly for where other players in the same scenario find themselves being taken off to prison.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a third level of accountability, and this is truly political accountability. We don't have a parliamentary system, so that, you know, our customs and traditions in our society is somewhat different. But, you know, in theory, things could get sufficiently hot that a person who holds high office, whether it's a service secretary or somebody in the office of the Secretary of Defense or the secretary himself, might no longer be politically viable to an administration. And finally, of course, we happen to have an election year. Now, you know, whether any of these issues are going to gain any traction in terms of what animates voters remains to be seen. But in theory, at least, you know, there's an administration that's seeking re-election. In theory, if there were failures of oversight or failures of preparation for the war at the very highest levels, well, the voters have a way to express themselves on that.
We're talking about reports on Abu Ghraib. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. And Sheridan joins us from Santa Rosa, California.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I would like to say that this is very definitely a cover-up. I spent 7 years in Vietnam and out in the Phu Vinh, and I knew the CIA very intimately, and I knew that they had torture chambers in province capitals throughout Vietnam. And the only difference between Abu Ghraib and those chambers was that we had no whistleblower. And William Colby and Colmer used to come. They'd come out. They knew exactly what was going on, and they knew about the tortures, and the tortures were terrible.
So, Sheridan, are what you're saying that the soldiers who are being charged in this regard are being scapegoated?
They're absolutely scapegoats, yes. That it goes right, that in Vietnam it went right up to Colby and Colmer, and here it's being orchestrated. Rumsfeld knew exactly what was going on in those prisons.
Well, let's get a response from Eugene Fidel.
I think there are a lot of pieces of the puzzle that haven't been painted in yet. And this goes to the question of what happens now, as well as responding to this caller's comment. The need, it has seemed to me, remains for a congressionally chartered independent commission. Frankly, I thought the Schlesinger board did quite a good job. And I admire the work they did and their seriousness of purpose. And I'm not damning with faint praise when I say that. However, it doesn't seem to me that this is the last word or that they have made it unnecessary for there to be the kind of high-level, congressionally chartered, independent inquiry that I think the country needs and I think that our friends and others around the world will also want.
So even this spate of reports, and before Michael Hirsch was saying there's at least five due out over the next few weeks and months, that's not going to do it for you?
Oh, it's just the reverse. I think the more reports there are, the more the entire matter loses focus. And I think that the loss of focus has been a built-in problem in this from the very beginning.
Sheridan, thanks, sir.
I think that these soldiers that are being made scapegoats, they've been offered some kind of deal. Now, look, if you just keep quiet and don't say anything, we'll get you out of this.
Well, several of them are contesting the charges, Sheridan. Thanks very much for the phone call. We're going to continue our conversation when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join us, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're discussing reports on prison abuse and taking your questions. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. Michael Hirsch, senior editor with Newsweek, is here with me in Studio 3A. On the phone with us is Eugene Fidel, the president of the National Institute of Military Justice. And Eugene Fidel, I wanted to ask you, there are cases ongoing right now, charges against some of the soldiers that have been charged in connection with Abu Ghraib. How might these reports affect the proceedings?
Well, there are two ways they might affect it, and they sort of pull in opposite directions, Neil. One is it may be argued by the accused that their right to a fair trial is compromised by this kind of publicity and public judgment before the fact, because there are some extremely harsh words used in the Schlesinger report. On the other hand, to the extent that the report suggests shortcomings at higher levels in the food chain, that may be seized upon by the accused to show that the finger of guilt should be deflected from them, or that there's some mitigation that should come into play when it comes time to decide on sentencing. So quite how this will play out is a little tough to predict, but that it will have some effect I'm sure is a very likely thing.
Well, we had already, I think just yesterday, a judge in one of these cases that's ongoing in Germany basically told the Army, look, you've got to do something about these military intelligence officials. If you don't do anything by the middle of September, I'm going to call them as witnesses and give them immunity.
That's quite right, Neil. And one point that I think is worth remembering is that the military justice system is not, you know, a wooden mechanical type of thing that just sort of grinds on. In fact, it can be very robust. It can roll with the punches. When things happen in the real world, there are lawyers involved, and they'll look at it immediately and say, gee, you know, what does this mean? Does this give us some new ammunition? Does this suggest other areas that we should be looking at? So you can no more predict, really, the path of justice in these cases than you can in any other case. And events show us day in and day out how unpredictable the law can be.
Eugene Fidel, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Eugene Fidel, president of the National Institute of Military Justice, with us by phone from his office here in Washington. And Michael Hirsch, I wanted to ask an email question to you. Alex in San Francisco writes, the country reacted to Abu Ghraib late. How have interrogation methods changed since then? Can suspects now just ignore their interrogators? What would they do with the highest ranks of al-Qaeda if they succeed in capturing them?
An excellent question, and really the most pertinent one, I think, for the future, as well as, of course, the ethical issues we're going to face as a country, because there are already reports suggesting that interrogators have been impeded because of the backlash from the scandal. We know that, for example, in Iraq, General Miller went back to basically a fairly strict adherence to techniques outlined in the Army Field Manual 3452, which is the basic doctrine for interrogations, which, you know, is much more restrained than some of the techniques. And this raises the issue of whether or not, you know, setting aside ethical questions about the techniques, whether sometimes they're effective. We know, for example, and this didn't come out in any of the reports, but a number of publications, including mine, have reported it, that there were discussions, many of the discussions about tougher techniques, like putting detainees in stress positions, were prompted by the resistance of al-Qaeda officials, suspects, at Guantanamo Bay, who were not responding to traditional interrogation techniques. And so that's why the CIA and others wanted to put the arm on them in a tougher way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is a very real issue here of whether we're going to be able to get information that is perhaps gained in morally dubious ways, but information that nonetheless might be able to avert a future attack.
Let's turn now to John Yoo. He's a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley, and he joins us from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Back in February 2002, when you were a lawyer with the Justice Department, you wrote a memo on torture, which is referenced in the Schlesinger report. It says that memo was a part of a chain of events which led to some confusion within the military command structure about what was allowed, what wasn't. Tell us what was in that report.
Well, there's two reports, opinions of the Justice Department. One is in February of 2002, and that wasn't about interrogation techniques or tactics. That was about the status of al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees under the Geneva Conventions.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first report that's also referenced in the Schlesinger report. That opinion basically said that al-Qaeda detainees are not covered by protections of the Geneva Convention for two basic reasons. One, al-Qaeda wasn't fighting on behalf of a nation state or party to the Geneva Conventions, and that al-Qaeda operates by violating the laws of war, for example, by attacking civilian targets directly, by not wearing uniforms, by operating covertly and blending into the civilian population. As to the Taliban detainees, many of whom are also held at Guantanamo Bay with al-Qaeda detainees, it said that the Geneva Convention covered the conflict in Afghanistan, but that Taliban units, because of the way they conducted themselves, by not fighting in uniforms, by not having a responsible command structure, and so on, could lose their protections as POWs and would be classified differently under the Geneva Conventions as well. There's a second opinion that is discussed in the Schlesinger report in the summer of 2002, which was an interpretation of the federal torture statute, which was passed to implement the International Convention Against Torture. And in that opinion, the Justice Department said that for something to qualify as torture, interrogation technique must be specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain and suffering that is difficult to endure.
Now, you didn't originate these memos. You just wrote them. But I wonder, as you read the Schlesinger report or read about it in the newspaper, do you think that these memos played a part in the confusion that they talked about sort of created the atmosphere where some people in Afghanistan and then later Iraq thought it was okay to use techniques that were not authorized?
First, let me say, I can't claim sole authorship, or I'm not claiming that I didn't write them either. I know some of the opinions that were released by the department and the White House have my name on them, so It's clear that I worked on them. But I don't want to say that, I claim the sole authority on what these opinions mean or say. But I think what you ask is a very fair question, because I think what the report released yesterday shows is that there was never a policy decision made in Washington at the Pentagon or at the White House to apply the interrogation techniques that were used at Guantanamo Bay to Iraq. Iraq is clearly covered by the Geneva Conventions, and so the normal standards of classifying detainees as prisoners of war apply there, then the standards for interrogations apply there. I think what the report yesterday concluded is that there was some migration, I think is the phrase the report uses, of techniques from Guantanamo Bay to Afghanistan and then to Iraq, and that what happened was that there was a failure of leadership by people higher in the chain of command to monitor what was happening and to take corrective action once they discovered what was going on. So it wasn't that, as I read the report, it's not that people in the Pentagon or so on ordered that these more aggressive interrogation techniques that were applied in Guantanamo Bay be applied to Iraq. In fact, it seems to be anything but. It seems the Secretary of Defense and his advisors tried to make very clear that they did not apply outside Guantanamo Bay, but that because of problems of implementation of policy in a very chaotic, extraordinary, and indeed ongoing security situation in Iraq, there were certain failures to make sure that those lines were made clear to people farther down the chain of command.
We're speaking with John Yu, a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley, formerly with the Bush administration's Justice Department, and also with Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Michael, did you have a...
I wanted to just make a comment on what Professor Yu just said, because one of the interesting things that came out of the Schlesinger report was, for the first time, I think, a clear line that was drawn between the opinions issued in memos, particularly the one that Professor Yu was mainly responsible for drafting, to what was actually happening in the field. One of the conclusions, the important conclusions of the Schlesinger report, is to say that the reasoning in the John Yu memo, the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel memo, that became the basis for President Bush's February 7, 2002 order, which is really the only word we have from Bush himself on this, in which he talked about those who were unlawful combatants, those who were outside the protections of Geneva, infected the thinking of people like General Sanchez in Iraq, and that on his own authority, apparently, but influenced by the thinking back in Washington, he decided to address some of the detainees as unlawful combatants who were not fully protected by Geneva, even though nominally Iraq was a Geneva protected war that was completely different from Afghanistan. And so you see this migration of legal reasoning going from the Justice Department and Mr. Yu's thinking all the way down to the ground to the commander of Joint Task Force 7 in Iraq. And I think that's one of the things that the Schlesinger report brings out in a very interesting way.
Mm-hmm. Professor Yu?
Well, I might add that, first of all, what should be made clear is that, yes, the report says General Sanchez independently interpreted, along with his legal counsel at the time, the requirements of the Geneva Convention and how they applied in Iraq. And two, I think the report endorses the idea that the Geneva Conventions do permit the idea that there are unlawful combatants, that the Geneva Convention can apply to a conflict, but there are people, because of the way they conduct themselves, who lose their POW protections. A third point that's worth making is that I think it's clear that none of those decisions had anything to do with the kind of photographs we saw in Abu Ghraib. So even though General Sanchez did interpret the Geneva Conventions in a certain way, and I think those interpretations have a long basis in international law. None of these things authorized the kind of photographs that you saw and that caused so many problems and really ought to be investigated and ultimately punished for, for the violations of policy and law that occurred in Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, two-thirds of the incidents, they say, at Abu Ghraib happened on Tier 1 at night as a result of that senseless sadism, or purposeless sadism, I think is how it's described in the report. But another third of the incidents at Abu Ghraib did happen in military interrogations with a military intelligence officials present.
Yes, I think the thing the report I think is not exactly clear on, and I think part of that is because the investigations are ongoing, is whether those abuses occurred in violation of the standards were set out by General Sanchez interpreting the Geneva Conventions on his own or not. I think, again, the reports from Abu Ghraib, both in the photographs and in the reports we've seen, went beyond even what General Sanchez had authorized. I mean, General Sanchez went somewhat beyond the traditional Army Field Manual 3452. Mm. But none of those things that he authorized went as far as the abuses that we're concerned about here.
John Yu, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
John Yu, professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley, and he was with us from member station KQED in San Francisco. We have just a few seconds left. We will have a response from the human rights community. We had scheduled an interview with them today. We got backed up, and we'll get a response from them about this report tomorrow on the show. But before we let you go, Michael Hirsch, what comes next? We have the Jones-Fay report being issued now, and what follows after that?
Well, I think the essential issue here is, as General Kern said today in his news conference, the difference between responsibility and culpability. You're going to have some prosecutions, perhaps going up to Colonel Pappas, who was head of the 205th Military Intelligence Brigade at Abu Ghraib. But in terms of actual criminal culpability, it may not go beyond there. But in terms of responsibility, people like General Sanchez, their careers are already damaged. We may or may not see resignation of any of the senior civilians in the Pentagon. I suspect not. I suspect that the real reckoning will probably come on November 2nd when the voters will decide collectively whether, you know, all of the Bush administration should lose their jobs or not. Because this administration, you know, has resisted really kind of putting anyone's head on the block for any of these failures. I mean, you've had, you know, the implication here is that Iraq, the problems at Abu Ghraib were part of a larger problem of failure to put enough personnel on the ground in Iraq.
Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine, thanks very much for being with us. Thank you. We appreciate your time today. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.